You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Yuri.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I cannot complain. Let me introduce you. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Yuri Dagan, and you are, for one thing, co-founder and CEO of Youth Biotherapeutics, which is working on longevity products, I guess, and doing longevity research. I'm definitely rooting for you there. In fact, more and more as each year passes, I wish you the speediest success. Now, what we're going to talk about is something where I'm not particularly rooting for you, just because we're going to talk about the lab leak hypothesis, and I'm a lab leak agnostic. I'm not really rooting for either side. This conversation is kind of a sequel to a podcast I did a few months ago with Peter Miller, who was on the other side of a kind of famous debate that you participated in. You and your teammate, Saar Wilf, went up against your kind of, well, reaction when I said teammate, you were kind of like, well, you were on the same team. You're on the, at a minimum, you were on the same team.
He's probably the leader of the team, and I'm the teammate that he asked to play one quarter, or I guess a third of the debate.
A third. There were three. It was more like hockey. It's soccer.
Legionnaire, invited.
No, hockey has three periods, right? You're in Canada. You tell me.
Three periods. And indeed. I guess I was just playing the middle period.
And so it was, the debate got a lot of attention, especially kind of in rationalist circles. Scott Alexander wrote about it. And one reason was there was a high stakes debate. Each side put up $100,000. The judges deemed Peter the winner. So he went home $100,000 richer. Now, I assume none of the money came out of your pocket. That was because this was originally a Saar Wilf thing.
It was completely Saar's thing. And now he's putting up $500,000 to debate Steve Kirsch on the vaccines. So Saar's a...
Whoa, Steve Kirsch. Now there's a piece of work. That'll be entertaining.
I actually had a debate with Steve myself a couple of years back. It wasn't very pleasant.
he's a person of not entirely even temperament, I would say. Unless I'm mixing him up, he was on with the Brett Weinstein podcast early on.
Yep.
Along with Robert Malone.
Him and Malone. Yep.
He kept erupting, right? I mean, I don't want to get sued. He seems like a perfectly nice guy, but I want to emphasize that. But he did kind of.
He's a very, I wouldn't say impolite, but it definitely came across somewhat rude, and people were commenting on it. I think since then he kind of toned it down a bit, but he's very brash, I guess, maybe the word.
Well, that'll be interesting. Now, wait, are you going to participate in that?
No. It's going to be a written debate. It's going to be very different. It's not, because I guess, this verbal thing, probably Saar has learned is not very fact-based, and often judges make decisions on who was a better debater rather than whose case is stronger. So, and we can maybe get to that in light of the root claim analysis.
Although, as long as we're talking about vaccines, you first came to my attention fairly early in the pandemic. I think first it was in discussion of ivermectin. Later, vaccines, you were involved in both conversations, and also you were early on the lab leak. You founded a group called Drastic, which is an acronym, I gather, that from quite early on was amassing evidence in support of the lab leak hypothesis. But I was, I wasn't aware of that part of you, but I did listen to some of the vaccine and ivermectin stuff, and I was impressed with your degree of knowledge. You seemed to be arguing in good faith. So I would actually like to ask you just quickly, in a few sentences, can you give me your current view of kind of the efficacy of the mRNA vaccines and the and risks, I guess? But I mean, because there's been a lot of stuff about, it turns out they don't slow transmission or something. It seems to me if they make you less likely to get gravely ill, they must to some extent slow transmission because they reduce the amount of replication within given people, but what do I know? How would you summarize the vaccine story?
Oh, we need it maybe a separate
podcast just on that. Yeah, I'm allotting you three sentences.
All right. Well, it's tough. Early on, the vaccines are very effective because they're formulated based on the original strain. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. the virus outcompetes the vaccines because it mm-hmm. mutates so quickly. Vaccines just can't keep up. And once the Omicron arose, that just completely limited vaccine effectiveness to almost nothing. Mm-hmm. But for their original strain, vaccines were very effective in preventing infection, which is, of course, a very important aspect in preventing transmission or just curbing transmission. Mm-hmm. Now, they were not sterilizing vaccines, which is like one of the points vaccine opponents made early on, that they're not effective at like completely stopping transmission because you still had a chance to get infected. But also vaccines are very effective at reducing the risks of bad outcomes, death or like high morbidity. So in terms of that, vaccines early on were very important, very useful, and they saved a lot of lives. Now, the mRNA platform is a whole different aspect because a lot of vaccines were actually not mRNA. They were like adenoviral vaccines using the kind of previously tried and tested platforms. mRNA technology indeed is a new technology. And some feel that it was kind of rushed. I mean, it was rushed. It was like Project Warp Speed, where a lot of the usual guidelines were not followed for novel vaccines because, I mean, it was an emergency. And so definitely some of the potential safety issues were not necessarily overlooked, but put in a context of general like public health interests, they were deemed to be less dangerous than the benefits of the vaccines. And they're definitely, if you kind of go back and analyze, were mandates worth it? I was never a fan of mandates.
Mm-hmm.
Were like risks for younger people, were they really overwhelmingly higher to the vaccines? Yeah. No, I'm just the vaccine part. Like, because a lot of the arguments were made, like younger people or children, their risk from COVID is not that high to justify, you know, vaccinate all of them with the vaccine. So there's a lot of different aspects that I fully support in investigating, like, and doing kind of backwards analysis of was it the right decision, was it the wrong decision. But of course, at the time, it was very, very kind of violent debate. There were people kind of entrenched in their positions on either side, and it became personal very quickly. And some of the people who were kind of in the same team on the lab leak side of things became, I wouldn't say bitter enemies, but they became opponents, case in point, kind of Brett Weinstein and myself, because of our very differing positions on vaccine safety and ivermectin, which, or hydroxychloroquine or any other kind of magic.
The vaccine, now they since have made a vaccine for Omicron, but meanwhile, have we moved on to another kind of COVID so that we're still kind of one step behind?
Yeah, in general, Omicron, I think, has much lower risk than the original strain for bad outcomes. And vaccine against Omicron, because Omicron is also very quickly mutating, and Omicron is just kind of a generic name, but the substrains of Omicron, again, they're mutating very quickly, outpacing anything the vaccine manufacturers can come up with, because you have a lag between, you know, the design and when you can actually put it into patients. That takes a lot of months and sometimes even years, and virus is just mutating much quicker than that. So you're always playing catch up and you're never catching up.
And in general, the vaccine seems to be evolving toward lower lethality.
The virus has evolved to a lower lethality. And yeah, definitely. And also by now, we've all been kind of infected with it several times, or a lot of people. So there's a lot of kind of natural immunity that a lot of the...
No, actually, I got it for the first time in August and had it while I was taping my podcast with Peter. So that brings us back to the subject at hand.
That was your first time?
It was my first time.
Wow, lucky you. Yeah. My first time was like...
I work at home.
Summer of 2020.
What's that? Yeah. I you know... and I was careful because I am older.
It's good. It's good too.
But also, my
by
wife,
now I think I've had like 4 or 5 times, to be honest.
Have you really?
Yeah, I did take Paxlovid even for one of the times. It was like in Canada freely distributed for people with COVID. So I did.
I took it last time, and I waited a couple of days to make sure my antibodies got in gear and did some work first in for the sake of my long-term immunity. But I did have a rebound. Yeah. So anyway, you know, first of all, I'm not standing in for Peter, just as I wasn't standing in for you when I talked to Peter. So, you know, in both cases, there may be these brilliant riposts to whatever is said that I'm not capable of making. But I'm just giving you a chance to kind of have your day in court. I'll push back when pushback is within my capabilities, but often it may not be. So the way I started, I should say, by the way, Saar Wolf, so Peter was a layperson who had just really very smart guy who had really boned up on viruses and stuff. He had really gotten interested in this. Saar Wolf is also not an expert. Of the three, you are the most naturally conversant in, biochemistry, molecular biology, and relevant things. But Saar runs this interesting thing called Root Claim, which is an organization that estimates the probability that controversial claims are true. You know, like, was the chemical weapons attack in Syria a false flag, and so on. And he had opined on this, and that's why he had laid down this challenge to debate him for $100,000. And the debate was, you and Saar, as you suggested, took turns. He took two-thirds of the time, you one-third, and then it was always Peter on the other side. Okay, so I started out my conversation with Peter by saying, you know, the argument, Saar is very much into Bayesian analysis. I've always thought of it, the argument as an argument about kind of dueling coincidences, which is kind of relevant to Bayesian analysis. I won't get into it, but how likely was this to be a coincidence? It can definitely figure into Bayesian analysis. But anyway, I think that's a good way to frame this. You know, one side says, well, what a coincidence. I mean, your side says, what a coincidence that we happen to see the outbreak in the city with a laboratory that's done the most coronavirus work, that collects these bat viruses, that has a manifest interest, I guess, in doing certain kinds of genetic engineering. And you have subsequently added to that list by looking into the research histories of some of the people there and so on. But anyway, the other side says, well, what a coincidence if it really did leak from this lab, that in a huge city the size of Wuhan, with a population, I guess, the size of New York City or something, it happens to first spread to this market where there is wildlife sold that is known to transmit, broadly speaking, these kinds of viruses, and indeed has been a problem in the past. And then, you know, just as you would add, carry what I said about your coincidence to a higher level of resolution, Peter would add things about where in the market the early cases appear and so on. So there's that. And then there's this is your side talking, what a coincidence that we have now found that there was a grant proposal by a U.S. NGO, I guess, Eco Health Alliance, I guess, is based in the U.S., and it was Eco Health Alliance, a proposal made to DARPA, the Pentagon Research Agency, that was turned down, but on the other hand, would have involved the Wuhan lab, would have involved gain-of-function research. And I gather, is it in the proposal itself that it says it would have involved the insertion of a fern cleavage site, which indeed turned out to be part of this virus?
Yes, it's in the proposal to engineer novel furin cleavage sites in SARS-like viruses. It doesn't say insertion per se, but they could have had furin cleavage sites that generated by mutations, and they could have had other ones generated by insertion. And I think insertion is something they might have considered, because it actually aligns the furin cleavage site of SARS, the SARS-like virus, with MERS. MERS was another type of virus that they were very interested in. Like, SARS and MERS were always talking about SARS and MERS, EquiHealth, Wuhan Institute of Virology, Ralph Baric, those were like the two main viruses they were interested in. And like even now with the gain of function things coming out of the like report from COVID Select, the gain of function work that EquiHealth got disqualified for is the gain of function work in MERS. And MERS was always like seemed like a one step ahead, because MERS was a more interesting virus, more recent, more lethal. And SARS was always like kind of like trailing behind. But they're always interested in those two families, MERS-like and SARS-like viruses.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, now like with the diffuse proposal, talking about engineering novel furin cleavage sites. And you're absolutely right. It's the dueling coincidences. Like, which one is the bigger coincidence? This virus spilling over just like a year after the Wuhan Institute of Virology, together with the EquiHealth, suggesting to look for viruses very similar to like this one, like with the specific spike protein difference from the first SARS virus. And also a year and a half after they proposed engineering this novel furin cleavage site, this unique feature that out of the hundreds known SARS-like viruses, we haven't seen before or since the outbreak of COVID. So this mm-hmm. is a huge coincidence. And after you start looking into like, what kind of research were they doing? The authors of the Fuse in one insert virology. And it seems like all of the research they've been doing in the years prior kind of leads up to SARS-CoV-2. And this is what I find ultimately kind of the more convincing circumstantial evidence than just like the only thing the zoonotic hypothesis has for it is that the Wuhan seafood market was the first cluster where the virus was noticed. And the proponents of the zoonotic hypothesis make it out to seem like that would be a huge coincidence that in a city like Wuhan, the size of New York, the market, the seafood market, would be the place where the virus would have its first cluster. Now, I don't like there's a distinct, I think, difference between actual being the first cluster or the first cluster where it was noticed. Because if we think mm-hmm. about it, like if a virus leaks out of the lab, how would it get noticed? Like what would need to happen in China for scientists to become aware of the virus or to actually sequence the virus to see that it's a novel virus, rather than assume that, oh, it's just another like yearly flu spike, right? And in China, they had this surveillance system because of the first SARS virus from like 2002, 2003 pandemic, that they were monitoring for clusters of unexplained pneumonias associated with wildlife or wildlife markets.
Mm-hmm.
So until then, until you get a bunch of people in the hospital with an unexplained severe pneumonias, you wouldn't even sequence what it is that they're sick with, right? If you just got a bunch of people with pneumonia in November and December, anywhere in China, they're just going to assume that, you know, this is just an annual mm-hmm. flu outbreak. So, and for that reason, the market is actually not an unexpected place for the virus to actually get noticed. Not just mm-hmm. noticed, but also create kind of the okay. first cluster of patients.
Let me bring up a point, and I should add like a little background. The way this conversation came about is during my last the conversation with Peter, I said at the end, look, if either Sar or Yuri want to come on and give their side, fine. And I was kind of flattered to find out that word reached you guys. It's always good to hear that at least somebody's listening to your podcast. Somehow Sar found out about that, and you wound up being the representative for now, although I may talk to him about his project broadly down the road. By the way, the other piece of background is that a Senate Select Committee on the Coronavirus, I think, came out today with a report in favor of lab leak hypothesis. You know, I will say I was kind of, well, not surprised, but nonetheless disappointed about what seemed like a pretty politicized presentation. I mean, I've only glanced at it, but the what they put on Twitter is like, here are the five strongest arguments in favor of lab leak. And the first one is the virus possesses a biological characteristic that is not found in nature. Well, as you know, the furin cleavage site is in fact found in nature. In fact, it is found in coronaviruses. It's true that it's not found in, SARS-like coronaviruses.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what they meant.
Yeah, but still, I'm sorry. It's just not found in nature. It's just a huge distortion.
No, it's just not found in nature. None of the SARS-like viruses we've looked at in nature, and we've seen, we know, close to 1,000 SARS-like viruses, different strains of SARS-like viruses in bats. None of them have a furin cleavage site. I'm sure that's what they meant. So it's not found in nature.
You know, I mean, I guess you could argue that. There were other things that got my attention.
Carefully worded, like from a scientific standpoint, you might word that a little more carefully. In this particular family of viruses, none of them have been observed before or since the pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, there were other things that got my attention about this. They kind of immediately got into various kinds of political messaging about Anthony Fauci and stuff. But look, it's a Republican-controlled subcommittee. We live in politicized times. I mean, I also didn't think, like, this is a separate matter. I didn't think they did that great a job of, it wasn't what I would have listed as, like, the five or six or whatever most powerful points you made. I mean, the first one, properly stated, made, you know, we can talk about that. But don't you agree?
I wish they talked to me.
Yeah, well, that's why.
They didn't ask.
But don't you agree that the list did not show a sophisticated understanding of the actual strength of the various forms of evidence?
I mean, it was definitely in a way for geared towards lay audience and maybe with a little bit of a politicized spin on it.
Okay.
But so, and I mean, they're not doing it for our benefit. I think you're absolutely right that
if a report wants to be taken seriously and list the six strongest pieces of evidence, they should be the six strongest pieces of evidence. But look, I would have done it differently.
I agree. Maybe the new administration will give me a call.
because we're heading into another Trump era, I may be too sensitive about this. Back to the thing you were talking about, though. Well, how likely would it be to reach the market? One thing Peter said that's relevant to what you said is that, look, if you look at the rate of growth of outbreaks, and we now know, I gather, what some of the rates of growth were in, like, other places, I think even other parts of Wuhan, and what it was in the market, it's like two doublings a week or something. He's saying, you know, if indeed it had hit, it had gotten much traction in other parts of Wuhan, it would not have been long before it became evident. Now, you're saying there was particularly close monitoring, or the seafood market particularly would get the attention of health authorities and so on. Do you attach any merit to that part of Peter's argument where he actually went through, you know, got into the rate of transmission and stuff?
No, this argument is based on a particular, like, a bunch of assumptions. And first of all, this based on, like, statistical doublings of a virus once it's in wide circulation. It doesn't really apply to early cryptic circulation when the virus is just kind of spilled over and is trying to establish itself. Because as Peter argued himself many times, only like 10% of all infections actually transmit to somebody else. Like 90% of people who get COVID don't transmit it to anybody. Like, and only like 10% are the super spreaders who actually infect other people. Mm-hmm. And early on, the strain, actually lineage A, which precedes lineage B, and the market, all patients from the market are lineage B.
We'll definitely get into the AB thing.
But it had a lower growth rate, at least based on some experiments they did. And of course, lineage A went extinct very quickly. And so early on, just that alone, that growth rate of that strain alone could be lower, not to mention that all these kind of dead end lineages that, or then chains of transmission that went nowhere. So just to say that, oh, it would have been much higher number of people if the virus was circulating earlier. And first of all, we don't even have the exact numbers of the patients. China didn't really do a proper retrospective search of how many patients were actually infected or like seropositivity numbers. I mean, they did later, but just the percentages are like huge, right? Especially in some areas of Wuhan. And to reliably use that in your kind of modeling, which again, models always have very different initial parameters that can greatly affect like the downstream numbers of people infected, just mm-hmm. to say that, oh, it's impossible because in my model, this would have been like 200 times greater. I do not subscribe to Peter's argument from that standpoint. Okay.
And I should say, by the way,
also, we know there were earlier patients. There was, and Peter dismisses the Connor Reeb case. Peter mm-hmm. dismisses the accountant Chen, who was not in the market, but he had like December 8th onset, which Warabi corrected to December 16th based on some interview. But China said, actually came out and in okay. response to Warabi's claim said, no, our analysis shows that accountant Chen living far away mm-hmm. from the market on the other side of the river had an onset and on December 8th. So there's always like huge uncertainty about early cases that mm-hmm. to like argue that because Peter okay. thinks. Okay.
Now Warby is a reference to, for one thing, a very well-known paper whose authors sound remarkably like Warby Parker, but aren't that. It's Warby and, what is it, Picar or something?
And Warby, yeah, Michael Warby, yeah.
So they did, are they the ones who did the analysis that shows, you know, like they have a map of the Wuhan seafood market, all the stalls, there's like 600 stalls, and you can see where the outbreak was and blah, blah, blah. I mean, they definitely did some of the early contagion studies of that area. I mean, and showed, were they the first ones to point out that like, look, the first outbreak on record is indeed very carefully, extensively concentrated in the market area, and then look within the market, and we'll talk about that. This is the research, right?
That's two different ones. The later okay. one, you probably like with the different stalls analysis, that's Chris different. Christoph. And they're also on that paper. Yeah, but like okay. the first author is different. Okay. And initially, yeah, it's the Warabi and their co-authors who had this paper saying that, yeah, the market is the epicenter of the outbreak. And they did this geospatial distribution of early cases and claimed that, yeah, the market associated cases cluster better than everything else. But of course, like most of the cases were actually not associated with the market. And there's a whole host of issues with the way they use their geoclustering to suggest that the market is therefore the source of the outbreak.
Were not associated. I mean, like what? Yeah. Most of the first, what, 50 or the first what were not?
177, I think. Yeah. I want to say like a third or maybe even lower. No, maybe even just 40.
If you cut it down and look at like the first 50, is the market concentration heavier, do you know?
Well, that's their argument, that the initial cases mm-hmm. with association of the market cluster more closely or right. yeah, more centrally on the market. That's their claim.
That's the argument. Okay. So within the market, and I also want to talk about, in a second, the characteristics of the market as a likely amplifier or a not likely amplifier. Because, you know, your argument is that, okay, there's a lot of places it could have spread, but if you look at the features of this market, it's a place that's particularly conducive to spreading. In fact, why don't we just do that part now? I mean, you're saying...
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
There's a lot of people, and it's cold, relatively cold. I guess not well ventilated.
Surfaces, yeah, mm-hmm. like the for I guess handling wildlife and mm-hmm. freezers and everything. So from that standpoint, just the cold surfaces we know allow the virus to remain viable for much longer, like much longer periods, like orders of magnitude longer. And of course, yeah, that's a huge market, centrally located, 10,000 visitors a day on the weekends, 100,000 visitors a day, 1,000 vendors who are like present there all the time. And so it's a perfect place for the virus to super spread. And indeed, markets were known during the pandemic. There's another like four or five markets that were the kind of origins of super spreading after like zero COVID. There are like two places in China, Chinfadi, Dalian, and then in Singapore and in Thailand. Like in each of those examples, we also have the situation where like there's no virus detected. And then boom, a virus then somehow gets amplified by the market.
And now these I was actually going to ask, is this the part where I think the way you put it in something you wrote was in two of five or three of five cases or whatever it was, it was spread in a seafood market or facility? Do you remember this phrase? I mean, I'm just wondering what a facility.
Yeah, there was like a ship port that, but basically it's open to the public, like wildlife or seafood market with like cold surfaces with a lot of traffic.
Okay. And then you've mentioned the market having an older clientele. That's a documented, that is a fact, a demographic fact about it. So in other words, they would have been more amenable to versions of the illness that would have come to the attention of health authorities.
More likely to be hospitalized,
It is an older clientele at that market?
Definitely it would. Yeah, I would assume, but I think I remember some actual analysis with the demographics of people who shop mm-hmm. at like the wildlife markets in China, just from that standpoint, and just by the kind of the vendors and the people who got sick, we know that they were on the older mm-hmm. side. I mean, young people don't. It's not like a shopping mall,
not a cool
or
thing
a
to do.
Movie thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Go down and buy a raccoon dog. It's like an old.
That's right.
Old person's game. By the way, they sell these are on sale live. I mean, the animals thought that Peter would say they're live. They're sold as take home and presumably
I think they actually can butcher them.
I see.
While you wait, but yeah.
But they're alive. Okay, yeah, so they're in cages.
Well, like the lobster tanks or whatever we have at, our seafood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then finally, in terms of amplifying characteristics, I believe maybe Sar brought up the idea that there's a lot of kind of loud vocalization, which is conducive to the spreading of this. And I don't, that's something that crossed my mind. I mean, I've been to markets where it's crowded, and so you've got the vendors talking to the customers, and they're all talking kind of loud because it's loud. I don't know if that's a documented fact, but I believe it's something he alluded to. And I can imagine that.
Also poor ventilation. That's a documented mm-hmm. fact. People spending, like, it's a huge market, like one of the biggest in central or the biggest in central China, one of the biggest in China, definitely the biggest in Wuhan. Like I said, 100,000 people every weekend. And so, like, if you think, like, I think Peter makes it out to be a huge coincidence that this is like 1 in 10,000 chance that a lab leaked virus would find the market and amplify there. But like, what are the places, typical places, 10,000 places like the seafood market in Wuhan? What are we talking about?
Well,
like shopping malls,
right? But on the other hand, you have to kind of add up their independent probabilities in some sense. Right? I mean, addition, strictly speaking, isn't the operation you do. But in other words, it's the cumulative probability of it happening in any one of all these, in any one of all the department stores, supermarkets, whatever, shopping centers, train stations, whatever, right?
That just one to be the perfect amplifier to be noticed.
I understand that. But if you're asking what are the chances that the first amplifier, let's hypothesize it escapes from the lab, there's going to be an amplifier. And it's and you're asking how likely is it to be at this market? If you add up, well, actually, it is straight addition. I mean, in a certain sense, I mean, if you divide Wuhan into these zones and one of them is the market, the sum of their probabilities of being the amplifier is 100%, right? All the zones.
Okay.
So that's what I'm saying. The question isn't just, well, none of these 10,000 places is very likely. If it's a little likely in 10,000, but there's 10,000 of them, that's not.
But there's not. That's the point. Like, how many places are there like the seafood market, which are like the perfect amplifiers?
But see, I'm saying that's, I don't think that's the question. I think
that should be the question. It's like, could it have been amplified in some school? Or some small shopping mall or a cinema, right? I think it's a much lower chance because it doesn't have the same population that's like spending, hours and hours there and poorly ventilated.
I agree that the market may be the single most likely amplifier, but the question of how likely depends on A, how many alternative sites there are that have a non-zero probability, and B, what their probability is. I'm just making the point in principle, like if there's 90 sites out there that each have a 1% chance of being the place, then the market only has a 10% chance, even though none of those rivals the market as a likely amplifier, right? We can agree on this?
I think I view it a little differently. There might be like hundreds of other smaller places which the virus reached first, but they would not produce a noticeable cluster that the authorities would then say, oh my God, there's 10 pneumonias coming out of that school, or 10 pneumonias coming out of that movie theater. Because even to get 10 pneumonias in a school or movie theater, you need, you know, thousands of people. Whereas the market is the perfect place because you get, you know, thousands of people, a thousand just vendors staying there all the time, exposing, you know, themselves to, if the virus starts, like makes a foothold in the market, it's very likely to not only spread itself, but to get noticed. Whereas in other places, it might be spreading, like schools, again, young children, they're much less susceptible, most of them are even asymptomatic. And Connor Reed, I like this example. Why? Because Connor Reed worked at a school. He taught English, like to kids, right? Mm-hmm. And he got sick, like he says, November 26th, or 25th or 26th, very early on. And initially he had a few weeks of symptoms. And the idea being that if he picked up at school, nobody would have noticed that because...
I mean, I will say Peter's elaboration on that guy's biography and how, what report we have about him having had it put some doubt in my mind, but I want to make sure and finish this one point. Okay, so if we define likely amplifier, like as, you know, what are the chances that in a given zone there will be a contagion that reaches a level that it is noticed by public health officials? Okay, if that's our definition, then my point stands, like you add up all the probabilities of the zones and they have to equal 100?
I mean, what zones are there? Like, I don't think...
Well, I mean, let's say that...
How long would it take for a movie theater to produce 16 sick people in a bunch of hospitals with the same movie theater? And people are like, oh shit, I got, you know, 10 patients that went to this movie theater. That's what happened. They got like patients in different hospitals. Each of them are from the Hunan seafood market. And they're like, oh, unknown pneumonia. Let's just sequence their virus. Versus like, people from the same movie theater or same school reaching that level. Again, schools have young people. Young people don't end up in hospitals.
No, I'm not arguing about any of the variables that are associated with amplification.
So this is what I'm saying. Like, what better place,
I'm just saying,
or at
that,
least equal place than to Hunan Seafood Market? Was
I'm,
there
I'm
in
just
Wuhan?
Saying, I'm just saying the question isn't what are the chances that any of these other 10,000 places would have been the amplifier in the sense I've just defined it. The question is, what are the chances that one of them, not any one of them, but one among them would have been, that the amplifier would have been in that population of 1,000 alternative sites? And that is the sum of their independent probabilities, I think. But anyway, maybe we will let one of us, well, we will both be ridiculed by commenters, and some of the commenters will be right and some won't be.
That's 100%. So people find reason to ridicule for even.
So within the market, I think another point Peter made is there are two things that are localized around, I mean, only a small portion of these 600 plus stalls sell animals, these wild animals, and they are in two zones. And there's kind of like a few stalls that do it in each. And I think you would say two things are concentrated around one of these. First of all, he says the outbreaks themselves are in some sense connected there. I guess that means there are people who had shopped there And secondly, he says the sampling for the virus found a lot of positives around there. Now, he concedes there's some degree of selection bias because
there's pure selection bias. They came back on January 12th to sample in these very stalls. Initially, they sampled January 1st on just a bunch of random stalls. And then they came back January 12th and sampled two stalls selling wildlife. That's where they got like a whole bunch of samples. Well, and out of those, only like five or six had tested positive, had any SARS-CoV-2 reads out of those. And the majority of those samples were negative.
Okay.
And there's actually a negative correlation between SARS-CoV-2 reads and like raccoon dog mitochondrial reads. So like most of the stalls that tested positive were not dealing with wildlife at all. Like they were selling fish, they were selling cattle. So this is, and this, like Jesse Bloom did this analysis. He showed that this claim basically has no basis.
Well, I think Peter said two things. One is he conceded some degree of selection bias. I think he said two things, as I recall. One is the when they came back, I mean, they kind of widened their sampling, I guess. But in any event, he said they did, you know, a number of stalls in the vicinity of the there's a stall that for various reasons, looking at various things, he considers the most likely origin point. They tested a number of stalls in that vicinity, and I think most of them didn't test positive or something. But the other thing he says is they tested all the drains. Ultimately, they tested all the drains in the market. Most of them tested negative, but the drain closest to this stall tested positive. So anyway, I've gotten, I guess, the information I was looking for.
It's also the closest to the toilets. And we know, like, the toilets are always a high super spreading location. It's also very close to that mahjong room that people were playing mahjong, and people think that they actually got infected in that mahjong room, or gambling room, as they called it. And yeah, there was one strain that had some reads. And again, they sampled those drains later. And it's not, I mean, it's closest, but it's not very close. It's actually on the end of the kind of the stall. But I mean, you can, you can like pinpoint all these like, or cherry pick arguments that you think prove the zoonotic hypothesis. But at the end of the day, that's just not very convincing. Like we're still have the market as later lineage, like all the patients with market association, early patients that triggered the alarm, they were lineage B patients with a later lineage of the virus.
Yeah.
And this whole idea that then the zoonotic team tried to like contort this information to fit the zoonotic narrative is that there must have been two spillovers. Lineage B spilled over first, despite being the first, like the ancestral lineage, the later lineage, sorry. And lineage A spilled over later, despite being the ancestral lineage. Somehow those two raccoon dogs were just kind of sitting there, but one infected people earlier with the later strain of the virus.
This was
based on flawed modeling and actually like a bug in the code that
we should, because we have a lay audience, I should explain the lineage A, lineage B kind of background, and then you can correct me if I get it wrong. Before we do that, do you have in your head like a number, like a percentage chance that you know, before this happened, if somebody said, what do you think the chances that the market will be the amplifier? Do you have a rough number in your head? Like you wouldn't say 100%, right? It could have been amplified somewhere else. There's some chance. But do you think, look, if you look at all of Wuhan, the chances are 50% or more, it's going to be that seafood market? Is that your view?
So you're asking, what are my kind of probabilities that if there is a lab leak of some novel virus, that novel virus will only get noticed after it gets to the market?
Right.
Well, definitely not 100%, but like, I don't know, one in 20.
Okay.
I don't know. Like, what else is that? Because people were saying, well, it could have gotten in the hospital, gotten noticed in the hospitals. Because, you know, like, that's where people end up, and they could have started super spreading there. And the hospitals could be like, oh my God, we got, you know, for some reason, an internal infection going on. But of course, hospitals are where people are like having much better protection against the viruses, and they already have kind of sick people there, so they maybe not even wouldn't even notice like a cluster of novel things. They see people with pneumonias all the time. And so out of 1,000 people with flu-based pneumonia, they got 10 people with the novel coronavirus-based pneumonia. Would they actually identify them? Like, what's the association with the hospital? Like, they wouldn't be, and the hospital wouldn't trigger, I don't think would trigger the alarm. Whereas a market, it's not a place where you expect people with pneumonias to occur. Whereas a hospital is the place.
You're at 5%, you're saying, but still, that's not, it's not like crazily improbable or anything. And you might, of course, revise that if you had time to reflect. I kind of hit you with that out of the blue. So as for lineage A, lineage B, I know this is important to you, and tell me if I've got this right. They discovered that actually early on, there were two lineages, A and B. It was clear from the mutations that A had preceded B in evolutionary time, and the inference is, the view is, and I gather this part is not controversial, you know, B evolved out of A. So B is a later variant than A. And yet, all of the people at the market, I don't know if it's all, but a disproportionate number, the people infected at the market, you're saying had lineage B, which is the later version. And you're like, well, how do you account for that? And I think you would say, well, my side has a way to account for it. It's like, you know, it leaked from the lab and spent a little time wandering around Wuhan without getting noticed. And meanwhile, it evolved into B, and then that's what was noticed. And then the natural origins people say, well, you know, it's possible that A and B arrived independently via wildlife. They're very closely related, and we could get into that. But I think you've got a third piece of evidence, and I don't know how recent this is, but you've written about it, that there's actually a third variant that is intermediate between A and B, and you find that significant. Is that right or wrong?
There is a variant that precedes A.
Oh, like precedes
ancestral to A, by one more mutation closer to the bat viruses. So A is not even the original virus that spilled over to humans. So basically, just based on that, we know that the market is highly unlikely to be the outbreak location, because we don't see this then earliest virus associated with the market. Like, if it was the source, then you would expect the market to have a whole bunch of like earliest strains or variations of earliest strains. But market is all of the patients associated with the market that triggered this alarm. They had lineage B or something later than lineage B, like an successor, descendant from lineage B. But to explain this double spillover hypothesis, the modelers like Pekar and Worabi, they had to exclude all of the known intermediates between A and B, because they posit that both A and B came from wildlife. There was no intermediate between A and B differ by two mutations. So an intermediate must have one mutation difference. Mm-hmm. And to basically posit this, they had to exclude all of the known patients with an intermediate strain. And there were many patients with strains that were intermediate between A and B invalidate this very hypothesis from the get-go. So, but to make their hypothesis work, they had to exclude all those, say those were all sequencing errors. They're not true intermediates, because they can't. You only have, like, if A and B are the original animal viruses spreading from raccoon dogs, like, you can't have a human have an intermediate between them. But this whole idea, like this whole double spillover, that B came to the market first and then the raccoon dog with A came later, or maybe just was there but didn't transmit until later, is invalidated completely by, first of all, the modeling was flawed, and second, we now have this pre-A, the humans with strains that predate A. So the idea that there was a raccoon dog with A and a raccoon dog with B, both of which gave the virus to humans, is completely contrary to the evidence.
So what is the total number of mutations between the pre-A, the earliest, and B?
Three.
And like, do you know about how fast these things tend to accumulate? Like, it depends on, of course, how how widespread the, you know, the contagion has gotten, because that's the number of
very stochastic and random process.
Yeah. Like
it could take days, it could take weeks. So yeah, I mean, this is a...
Because, I mean, the reason I ask is, I remember Peter saying something about the way they collect these, you know, the way these things get from farm to market is, you know, a truck goes around to one farm, picks up a few raccoon dogs, goes to another farm, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know how long it is between first pickup and the time they finally get to the market, leaving aside the time in which, you know, the animals may spend time together in the market. But I assume one thing he thinks is that, well, I don't know if that's part of a scenario that, you know, you've got some time for this to be spreading and conceivably mutating. I don't know what his exact scenario is, and I don't know if you do.
But, nobody does, and they don't have an exact scenario. They don't have like an approximate scenario. How does this virus end up exclusively in Wuhan from wildlife trade? Where do these raccoon dogs live to get in contact with bats that are like 1,500 kilometers away in Laos or southeastern China in Yunnan? Like, why would you need a raccoon dog from Yunnan? They got locally sourced raccoon dogs. But I don't understand.
Weren't some of the earlier, at least one of the earlier SARS things that wound up in humans a long way from bat populations? I mean, hundreds of miles?
The first SARS, yeah, they were like 700 kilometers. But they were within the belt of this kind of wildlife-eating belt in southern China. And they were, contrary to SARS-2, SARS-1 had multiple introductions. Multiple outbreaks. We know multiple animals. They traced it to palm civets, to raccoon dogs. We have like five different civet strains. They sampled in different markets and restaurants. And they actually, I think, they had a farm. They found a farm in Yunnan, in Kunming, I think, with those animals. Like, but nothing of the sort. And but still, it's kind of within the belt.
Is what you just said not consistent with Peter's claim about multiple spillover of different variants? I mean, that's what happened there, right? You just described a situation where there were different variant or that spilled over?
Different strains in different places. Even like within the same city in different restaurants and different markets. Yeah, they have multiple markets. Whereas, yeah, multiple markets, multiple introductions. Whereas in this case, it's just a single introduction and of a later strain, ancestry later, in the human, and all of those animal strains that they found with SARS-1, like in civet strains, they were obviously clearly ancestral by many mutations to the human strains that were later found, or like the human strains that were found to be in the outbreak, the earliest patients. The animal strains were much, much more ancestral. In this case, it's lineage B is later, ancestrally later than lineage A. And so it's completely like we have absolutely nothing resembling the first case, the first SARS outbreak case in terms of evidence.
Okay.
And yeah, like again, like why is this would be an exclusive arrangement for Wuhan, where this raccoon dog or even like two different raccoon dogs would also to have two raccoon dogs develop two different lineages of the virus. Initially, they must have had many, like hundreds of thousands of raccoon dogs on that farm transmitting the virus. And then to only have these two raccoon dogs end up in the same market in Wuhan, it's just, to me, completely implausible.
Okay. The now, in a few minutes, we're going to go into what we call overtime, which is... a part of the conversation that's available to Non-Zero newsletter members, that is, they pay subscribers. We always appreciate their patronage and encourage everyone to help support this.
We haven't even gotten to the good stuff.
Enterprise. Well, I know, and that's why I want to give you a few minutes with the public audience. I want to encourage everybody to follow us. We may go on for quite a while. I think you have almost an hour of time remaining, but and we want to get into the more the fine-grained evidence at the level of molecular biology. But I want to give you a chance to, I mean, two things. First of all, have we hit the kind of high points of the non-molecular biology evidence? You can, why don't you first answer that question, then I'll give you a chance to at least preview, you know, a central claim or two about the you know, the fern cleavage site, whatever.
Not sure what you mean, like in terms of for the lab leak hypothesis or for the lab leak.
This is all about the lab leak hypothesis. What I mean is, I think of there as being two kind of categories of evidence. One is the realm we've been in, and then there's the stuff that to really intelligently assess, it helps to understand something about genetic engineering and because it's about the diffuse proposal that I mentioned before, which in some sense anticipated a study at Wuhan involving Fern Cleveland site, even if the grant was not approved. Nonetheless, your theory is that Wuhan, you know, they're already, you got them thinking about this, and they just found a way to get it funded and did it. So that's the part I want to get into next. And I guess
It doesn't require molecular biology expertise. This is more, again, just kind of pattern matching, what kind of research they were doing and what kind of aspect does the virus have. So
I'll ask you,
you can get into the details of insertion.
I have some
codons.
Questions. That,
okay. I mean,
there are some things I don't understand. But anyway, in what we've been talking about, market is amplified, you know, these two coincidences. What are the chances, it happens at a city with a lab? And, what are the chances that if it gets out of the lab, it happens in, it spreads in the market first, or is noticed there first? Anything, are there major things we haven't covered here?
Don't think so. I mean, mostly talked about the market, but in general, the framing of it, you're right. So we discussed kind of on the lab leak side, what are the chances that it actually gets to the market, gets noticed in the market first. And I guess we now can talk about the other coincidence, like what are the chances that a virus randomly spills over in Wuhan with the same place as the lab, and not just any virus, but the virus, precisely the virus the lab was hunting for, and has a feature that the lab was contemplating creating, genetic engineering, a unique feature that none of the other SARS-like viruses have. So we can definitely talk about the.
Okay, so just to kind of preview that, we're going to talk about what that proposed research was, and you're certainly conversant in other documentary evidence that has come to light in terms of through freedom of information requests, I think, about how the people who were going to apply for the grant were talking about it and what they had in mind and so on. I mean, the lead investigator was a guy at I think the University of North Carolina, somewhere around there. But is that not right? Is it Ralph Baric? What's his name?
Well, I mean, I would say the PI was Peter Daszak, was the head of the EcoHealth Alliance.
Well, he's the head of the whole EcoHealth Alliance. Yeah.
And Peter, so he would have been. Ralph Baric and Zhenling Shi were probably like the co-equal research partners. And in the grant, as Peter Daszak actually says in the comments, he's trying to play up the American side, but he's like writing, once we get the money, actually, Shi Zhenling was going to do like equal amount of work something to
I
that.
I remember
basically
that passage when he's saying, look, it's a U.S. funder. We got to emphasize the American role. But yes, significant work can be done in Wuhan.
I actually think more of that research, like the more I looked at it, was done by Chinese scientists or Chinese American scientists, but with affiliation in Wuhan. Like Fang Li and Ralph Baric are always like two of the senior authors, and Shi Zhengli often, and Shibo Jiang and Lang Yingdu, and they're all like working on this, but it's really just Ralph Baric who is the kind of non-Chinese researcher on this, and the others have a connection to either Chinese research institutions or affiliation, or Fang Li was a visiting professor at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So basically, what they were working with EcoHealth and Peter Daszak and American taxpayer money. And so from that standpoint, there was collaboration included with the University of North Carolina. But if that funding didn't come through EcoHealth, they could have well used Chinese funding sources to do research without their frenemies, or, you know, they're always like in scientific circles, your collaborators are often your competitors, and you don't want to get scooped. And of course, the advantage that the Wuhan Institute of Virology had is that it had access to all these bats and all these new viruses, which Ralph Baring did not have. He was basically at the mercy of them sharing whatever new interesting viruses they found with him.
That's another thing we may get into is the database of viruses, what we do and don't know about what viruses Wuhan had on hand. You think you have provided evidence to the effect that we knew a lot less than some have said. I mean, for all we know, you would say, funny. So we'll get it. You would say for all we know, they did have viruses on hand that could have been readily converted into the virus we saw.
They definitely had unpublished viruses, one of which the backbone for SARS-CoV-2.
So we're going to head into overtime now and talk about this whole, fern cleavage site. Your site says it has various of the hallmarks of a product of genetic engineering. Their side says in some respects it doesn't. And there's the question of its frequency of appearance in other in nature and so on. So I want to get into that, maybe a little more into this, what we do and don't know about what they had on hand. And also, if we have time, get into the sociology of this a little. In other words, the argument, the people involved in the argument, and kind of what that's been like. Okay, so I hope people will follow us. Thanks to everybody who's listening this far. In any event, now we are going into overtime.